I want to begin this morning by sharing with you from one of the devotional books that I like to read each day. And I, as I told the first service, I've begun to believe that I'm addicted to devotional books. Because there are so many that I like to read on a daily basis. One of the ones I like to read is by John Maxwell. It's called A Daily Reader. How many of you know who John Maxwell is? A lot of you know. He's a great writer and he's a great speaker, does seminars about leadership and relationships between people. And I was reading in Maxwell the other day, and I read this, and I thought it was pertinent to our study of Jephthah, the judge, in Judges chapter 11. Let me read. A few years ago, I heard my friend Chuck Swindoll tell the story of Chippy, the parakeet. He said the bird's problems began when the woman who owned him decided to clean up the seeds and loose feathers from the bottom of his cage using a vacuum cleaner. Yeah, you know where this is going, right? When the phone rang, the owner turned to pick it up, and you guessed it, with a thud and a whoosh, Chippy was gone. The owner quickly turned off the vacuum and unzipped the bag. There was Chippy. He was stunned but breathing. Seeing that he was covered with black dust, his owner rushed Chippy to the bathtub, where she turned on the faucet full blast and held the little bird under the icy water. At that point, she realized that she'd done even more damage. And she quickly cranked up her blow dryer and gave the wet, shivering little parakeet a blast. Chuck finished the story by saying, "Chippy doesn't sing much anymore." The application that Maxwell makes of the story is this: people who are unable to overcome the past are a little like Chippy. They allow their negative experiences to color the way they live. No matter how dark a person's past is, it need not color his present permanently. That's what I think we're seeing in Jephthah, in this Judge Jephthah that we began to study 2 weeks ago and really studied in earnest last week, and that's what we see in him. He could have let his past, he had a difficult past, he had a difficult upbringing. He was driven from his home because of the circumstances of his birth. He was driven from his home, had to live apart from his family. And he could have let that hamper his life. He could have let that be a problem for all of his life. But instead, he didn't do that. Instead, he trusted the Lord and walked with the Lord. And the Lord used him in such a mighty way. That's Jephthah. That's Jephthah. Now, before we get into the curse, or not the curse, but rather the vow that Jephthah made, can I share another parakeet story with you? I'm dying to share this one with you. So you got a parakeet in a cage again, okay? And again, the lady decides she's going to vacuum the bottom of the cage, right? So she's vacuuming, and she gets distracted, as in the other story. She gets distracted, and boom! There goes the parakeet. And she's frantic, and she opens the vacuum cleaner and she pulls out the poor little parakeet that's lifeless and limp. And she thinks, what am I going to do? And she calls a friend, and a friend says, well, I heard if you put gas on the tail, it'll revive them. And so she gets some gas and puts it on the tail of the parakeet. And believe it or not, the parakeet revives and starts flying around the room and flying around and flying around and flying around. And then all of a sudden, bam, drops to the ground dead. You know what happened, don't you? He ran out of gas. Okay, so ends my career as a comedian, all right? Who were we talking about? Oh yeah, Jephthah. And we're talking about the unwise or unnecessary. I like the word unnecessary. Many people have called his vow many things. They've called it hasty, they've called it unwise, they've called it rash. I think at its heart it was an unnecessary vow. We're told when we look at chapter 11 and verse 29 that the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah. Jephthah is about to go to war against the Ammonites. And the Spirit of God comes upon him. That means the Spirit of God empowered him. The Spirit of God enabled him to have victory and to be victorious in this battle against the Ammonites. God had already empowered him. God had already enabled him. So what does he do? We read in verse 30, and Jephthah made a vow to the Lord. If you give the Ammonites into my hands, whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return in triumph from the Ammonites will be the Lord's, and I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering. Good enough as far as it goes. Because in that day, animals and people lived together on the first floor of the houses of that day, so the likelihood of an animal being the first out is pretty likely. But the point here is that, why did he make this vow? God had already come upon him. God had already empowered him. God had already enabled him. And he makes this vow. Now, the interesting thing about chapter 11 and then the first part of chapter 12, when we get into it about Jephthah, is in both cases, an unnecessary use of the tongue of words causes a problem. An unnecessary use of the tongue causes difficult, horrible problems. Well, Jephthah wins the victory. Verse 32 talks about that. He wins the victory. God gives him the victory. They defeat the Ammonites. Verse 34, when Jephthah returned to his home in Mizpah, who should come out to meet him but his daughter, dancing to the sound of tambourines? She was an only child. Except for her, he had neither son nor daughter. When he saw her, he tore his clothes and cried, "Oh, my daughter, you have made me miserable and wretched because I made a vow to the Lord that I cannot break." The vow, as you remember from just a moment ago, was it will be the Lord's, the first thing out of my door will be the Lord's, and I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering. Now, as I told you last week, there are two ways that scholars understand this passage and what happened in this passage. The one way is to understand that Jephthah actually sacrificed his daughter, a human sacrifice, as a burnt offering. And people blame that on his Canaanite background. Remember, he is the product of a Hebrew father and a Canaanite mother who was a prostitute. And that's the reason that he was shunned by his family and caused to leave and go into exile away from his family. And so what scholars say is there is enough of his Canaanite background in him, and Canaanites practiced human sacrifice. Therefore, there's enough of his Canaanite background that he actually did sacrifice his daughter, taking her life as a burnt offering. The other side of the coin, the others say this, is that what he did was he devoted her for her whole life to temple service as a virgin. That is, for the rest of her life, she would be devoted to serving the Lord in the temple, would never marry, would remain a virgin. Therefore, she would never have children, which was a real mark upon women in that day, not to have children. It was a real disappointment, not just to her, a real grief, not just to her, but to her father as well. For she'd never have children, he'd never have a posterity. She's his only daughter. The text has already told us that. Now, I have to tell you, I agree with the second position. And I'm going to tell you why. I'll give you 9 reasons that I do not believe for a minute that Jephthah sacrificed his daughter as a burnt offering, as a human sacrifice, that I believe that what he did was to commit her, devote her to temple service as a virgin for the rest of her life. That's what I think this oath, how this oath worked its way out. Let me give you 9 reasons I believe that, 9 observations. Number 1, and by the way, you can make your own decision. There are many commentators who disagree with the position I take. I take the position with the other commentators, and I'm going to give you the reasons why and let you make up your mind what you think actually happened here. The trouble is, as I told you last week, the text is sufficiently ambiguous to support either view. The text is sufficiently ambiguous to support either view. This is the reason I believe he devoted her to temple service. Number one, the Mosaic law did not allow child sacrifice. The Mosaic law did not allow, in fact, it forbid human sacrifices. You can read this in Leviticus 18:21, Leviticus 20, verses 2 to 5, Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 31, and Deuteronomy chapter 18 and verse 10. That one I'll read to you really quickly, Deuteronomy chapter 18 and verse 10. We read this, "Let no one be found among you who sacrifices his son or daughter in the fire, who practices divination or sorcery." Deuteronomy 18:10, and again, it's found in those other places. The Mosaic law forbid human sacrifices. The Mosaic law did not allow for child sacrifice, as was common in the Canaanite culture around Israel, but it was forbidden to Israel. Now, there are those who say, well, don't forget, Jephthah came from a Canaanite background as well as an Israelite background. There's his Canaanite background coming to the fore, and therefore he would feel all right sacrificing her. I don't believe that, and I'll tell you why. As we studied last week, Jephthah, though he had been driven away from Israel, though he had been driven away from his family, Jephthah, when it comes time to confront the Ammonites who want to go to war against Israel and who wrongly claim property of Israel, when it comes time, Jephthah has a wide knowledge of the Old Testament. He has a wide knowledge of the law. He has a wide knowledge of the history of Israel. When you go through the way he answers the Ammonites, you can't help but know this is a man who's been studying. This is a man who has been worshiping God, Yahweh, of the Hebrews. I think that it wasn't his Canaanite culture that came to fore. What we see coming to fore in his life is his Hebrew background, his background in the Word of God. Not only that, we see that in his daughter. What a magnificent young woman she is. When her father says, "I have done this," she says, "May it be to me as you have committed to the Lord." She doesn't fight him. She doesn't say, "This isn't fair." She doesn't say, "But I've been looking forward to marriage and children." She doesn't say, "Don't you want a posterity, Jephthah?" She says, "Do what you have vowed." How do you raise a child like that, that loves God that way and would submit themselves in that way? I don't think for a minute that Jephthah's Canaanite culture is the problem here. I believe that the Mosaic law forbid human sacrifice, forbid sacrificing children, and I don't think he did it. Number two, second observation, is Jephthah's daughter mourned that she would never marry or bear children. Look at chapter 11, verses 37 to 39. "But grant me this one request," she said. "Give me 2 months to roam the hills and weep with my friends because I will never marry." "You may go," he said, and he let her go for 2 months. She and the girls went into the hills and wept because she would never marry. There, over and over, it's because she would never marry, because she would never marry. The emphasis seems to be in the rest of this passage, her not marrying, her not having children. That seems to be the emphasis, and that seems to be the mourning and the grief that's going on here. And yet there are those who say, well, the reason she'd never marry is because she'd be dead. So, as I said, it's sufficiently ambiguous. After the 2 months, verse 39, she returned to her father, and he did as he had vowed, and she was a virgin. There's that emphasis again upon her virginity, upon her never having children, never marrying. That was what she mourned. As one writer said, she mourned her maidenhood, not her maiden age. She mourned her maidenhood, not her maiden age. Third observation. In Leviticus chapter 27, there are the regulations listed for vows. Among those regulations in Leviticus 27, it permits for a person to be redeemed from a vow by a monetary payment. In other words, you could make a vow that included a person, but you could make a monetary payment in the place of giving that person, of offering that person. So therefore, according to the law, there would have been a way out. But critics say, yes, it allows for a monetary payment to release a person from a vow, but there's nothing in those regulations in Leviticus 27 that talk about perpetual service in the temple. Now, don't you think the way Jephthah responded and the way he loved his daughter, don't you think that he'd take whatever money he had, that he'd take whatever the spoils of war had brought him against the Ammonites and pay everything he had to redeem her? Don't you think he would have done that? But instead, he devotes her, I believe, to perpetually serving in the temple. The reason I believe that is because there are several places in Scripture where it talks about the women who served at the temple, or at the tabernacle or the temple, and we're never quite explained who these women are. But there seems to be a group of women throughout the history of Israel who served at both the tabernacle and later in the temple. If you want some passages for that, Exodus chapter 38, verse 8, 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 22, Luke chapter 2, verses 36 to 37 are some of the places that talks about these women who served in the temple. Now, virginhood was not necessarily a requirement to serve in that way, but that doesn't prevent Jephthah from doing this, and there was this group of women from the time of the Exodus. Number four. The reason, again, that I don't believe Jephthah took her life is because it's hard to imagine a hero of the faith practicing human sacrifice. It's hard to imagine a hero of the faith. And that's what Jephthah is. Remember, I've mentioned several times that Jephthah is mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 32 as one of the heroes of the faith of Israel. He's mentioned along with Gideon. He's mentioned along with Barak. He's mentioned along with Samson. He's mentioned along with David as a hero of the faith. But again, the critics say, well, Samson's mentioned there and he was about as immoral as you can get. Well, yeah. And next week we're going to talk about why God would use such an immoral person as Samson in such a mighty way. But my answer would be there's a big difference between being immoral and killing another human being. The fifth thing, Dr. Thomas Feigert, one of my Old Testament professors, said this, the language of the vow does imply that he might expect a human being to meet him at the door, but that does not imply that he had to sacrifice a human being to fulfill his vow. Number six, and this kind of follows on that, some believe that there are actually two parts to this vow. If you look with me at chapter 11 and verse 31, this is his vow. Whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return in triumph from the Ammonites, now this is the way the NIV translates it, will be the Lord's, and I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering. Now there are those who say that a legitimate translation of this verse, verse 31, would be this. Whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return in triumph from the Ammonites will be the Lord's, or I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering. It will be the Lord's, not and I will sacrifice it, or I will sacrifice it. That's a legitimate translation, but I got to tell you, it's not the best translation of the Hebrew in this passage. I'm going to be honest with you. It's a legitimate translation, not the best translation. The first part of the vow is, it will be the Lord's. It will be the Lord's. This phrase is used, many point out, of people symbolically, but never used of animals. It's used of people symbolically. Symbolically, that's the key word, but never used of animals. Or, I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering, a phrase we find in the Scripture never used of humans. It's never ever used of humans in the Scripture. So, again, it's a possibility. It's a possibility that that is the proper way to translate that. Well, number 7. Judges 11:39. We've already looked at this where after the 2 months she returned to her father, he did to her as he had vowed, and she was a virgin. From this comes the Israelite custom that each year the young women of Israel go out for 4 days to commemorate the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite. Well, he did to her as he vowed, but the implication is, and she was a virgin. That seems to explain how he carried out his vow. Implying not execution, but implying lifelong service. Number 8. To do a human sacrifice as a burnt offering would require and necessitate the involvement of a priest, which is unthinkable. Where is he going to find a priest who believed Yahweh and who would participate in a human sacrifice? Number 9. The tragic consequence of the vow is that she would bear no children. Jephthah would never have grandchildren. Every Hebrew girl looked forward to marriage. Every Hebrew girl looked forward to having children. She would never have that because she would be dedicated to service in the temple for the rest of her life, robbing her of children and robbing Jephthah of grandchildren. All right, I told you 9. I'm going to throw in number 10 for free. Okay? I don't really consider it number 10, but it is something to consider. It's not talking about vows, but in Proverbs 26:2, it talks about bringing curses on a person. And so I think it's a little bit different than the vow that Jephthah made, but let me just throw this in. She had done nothing to bring a curse upon herself. Proverbs 26:2 says that a curse cannot be placed on one who does not deserve it. It doesn't stick. So a curse can't be placed on someone who doesn't deserve it. So if you see this vow in terms of a curse, then that's where the problem comes in. That's why I'm not really calling it number 10. But it is something to consider that a curse cannot be placed on somebody who doesn't deserve it, and surely she did not deserve it. So for these reasons, I believe that Jephthah dedicated and devoted his daughter to temple service as a virgin for the rest of her life, never to have children, never to provide him with grandchildren. I think that was the mournful part of this. Now, as far as this ceremony that they talk about, this 4 days to commemorate the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite, we don't know much about this custom. We really don't know much about it in the history of Israel. Let's talk for a moment about Jephthah's consistency. You see, he was consistent to keep his vow. But the question that you and I have to think about and have to ask is it right to be consistent like that? Is that what we should do? Suppose that we make an unwise statement or vow, should we keep that vow if it's inconsistent with a higher calling? Jephthah should have seen a higher calling here, but he didn't. Just so he could be consistent. You see, there's an example for this in the scripture. There's another place where somebody made a rash vow and it was going to cost somebody's life, but the people prevented it from happening. Does anybody remember what that other place might be? You got a lot of Bible there in front of you, right? You know what it might be? Anybody can think of a time when somebody made a rash vow and it would have cost, I'll give you one more clue, it would have cost his son's life? Saul and Jonathan, that's, you can look it up in 1 Samuel chapter 14 and verse 45. Remember, Saul made a vow that none of his soldiers should eat anything the whole day while they were pursuing the battle. And Jonathan had not heard that vow, and he took some what? Honey. He ate some honey, and it revived him, and it would enable him to fight the rest of the day. But Saul finds out that somebody violated the vow, and then he finds out that it's his son Jonathan, and what does he want to do? He says, I'm going to put him to death. I made a vow. But the people intervened, and they said, you're not going to do that. Jonathan provided us with a great victory today. You're not going to take his life to fulfill an unworthy, unnecessary, hasty vow. One writer said, Jephthah and his poor daughter had no one to save them from their deluded folly. Jephthah's fear of inconsistency was not only unnecessary, it was tragic. It was tragic. The writer said this as well, let the man who prides himself on his uncompromising consistency take care lest he carry it to such an extreme that it becomes stubborn folly. That's what this is. This isn't commitment to a vow made to the Lord. This is stubborn folly on the part of Jephthah. I like, and it's not Bible, but it's, and so you may not like it. I'm going to share it with you. Ralph Waldo Emerson said this, a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. That was a foolish consistency that Jephthah was living out. And somebody might say, well, doesn't it say in the Bible, consistency, thou art a jewel? Does it say that in the Bible? Don't raise your hands, okay? Does it say in the Bible, consistency, thou art a jewel? Nope. Never found in the Bible. It's one of those many verses that people say is found in the Bible, but is not found in the Bible. Cleanliness is next to godliness. Not in the Bible, folks. Spoil the rod, spare the child. Not in the Bible, folks. Does talk about children and spanking, but doesn't say spare the rod, spoil the child. Doesn't say those things. This is another one of those consistency thou art a jewel. Where does it come from? Anybody know? Nobody knows. We don't know where it came from. Most people attribute it to Shakespeare. Before we leave this section of Scripture, what about Jephthah's daughter? One writer said, the attitude of his daughter, whether death or perpetual service, she would bear no children, which in Israel was a cause for a great grief. She willingly submitted because he had promised the Lord. Another said, the nobility of character shown by Jephthah's daughter has made her one of the world's great heroines, and I agree. Let me close out this section, and then we'll get into, we're going to get into 12, 1 to 7, so don't get ready to get up yet. I like one of the books I like to study when I the various resources I study every week is called The Bible for Dummies. I just love it. They're such a fun book to use, The Bible for Dummies. You can make your own joke about that. Okay, The Bible for Dummies says this. Now you may be saying, wait a minute. You mean to tell me that God was okay with this kill your daughter because of a vow stuff? Well, the text doesn't say exactly, but we're going to go out on a limb here and say, no, vows are very important in the Bible, especially when made to God, but not murdering others is also up there on the morality scale. Moreover, child sacrifice is repudiated in the Bible and is one of the chief reasons why God allows Israel to make war with the Canaanites. Finally, some have noted that Jephthah's vow was a mistake in the first place because God is already said to be with him. If Jephthah had the faith to believe this and not make a hasty vow, then this whole situation could have been avoided. And finally this, we do not know what actually happened to his daughter, one writer said, the one who came to meet him, whether she was burned as an offering or set apart as a virgin, thus denying Jephthah any hope of descendants since she was his only child. What we do know is that his rash vow brought him unspeakable grief. So let's be careful in our words. Let's be careful in the things we say. Let's be careful in our vows. And as this writer says, instead of pouring out promises to God for the future, commit to obey him today. Interestingly enough, in the aftermath of this battle against the Ammonites, in the aftermath of this vow by Jephthah, we have chapter 12, verses 1 to 7, where Jephthah comes into conflict with the Ephraimites. The Ephraimites were a tribe from Israel on the western side of the Jordan River, whereas the Gileadites were on the eastern side of the Jordan River. So what happens is, the background to this is, the Ephraimites learn of this war and this victory against the Ammonites, and they go and cross the Jordan to the east side of the Jordan, the area called the Transjordan, and they confront Jephthah. That's chapter 12. Interestingly enough, once more, words cause tragedy. Words cause tragedy. Look at chapter 12, verse 1. The men of Ephraim called out their forces, crossed over to Zaphron, and said to Jephthah, "Why did you go to fight the Ammonites without calling us to go with you? We're going to burn down your house over your head." What kind of a threat is that? That's a threat. We're going to kill you and your family. That's what that is. We're going to kill you and your family. That's the threat. That's the first unwise words that are spoken here. Oh, how they needed Proverbs 17:14, which says, starting a quarrel is like breaching a dam, so drop the matter before a dispute breaks out. Good advice. Good advice. Proverbs 17:14. Jephthah's answer. Jephthah answered, "I and my people," this is verse 2, "were engaged in a great struggle with the Ammonites, and although I called, you didn't save me out of their hands. When I saw that you wouldn't help," what's he saying? We did call you to the battle, but you wouldn't come. "When I saw that you wouldn't help, I took my life in my hands and crossed over to fight the Ammonites, and the Lord gave me victory over them. Now why have you come up today to fight me?" Jephthah's answer is, you didn't come when you were called. You were called to the battle. Why are you coming now? The implication being that the Ephraimites are coming after the battle is won because they want a part of the what? Spoils. Now, these Ephraimites are a troublesome group of people. They gave another judge some trouble in chapter 8 by the name of Gideon. They came against him in the same kind of way. Apparently, this tribe was argumentative and divisive. That seemed to be the pattern of this tribe. Well, this time their argumentativeness, this time their divisiveness is going to cost 42,000 lives. This time their unwise words are going to cost 42,000 lives. So not only do they threaten to burn Jephthah's house down around him, they also say in verse 4, we read, Jephthah then called together the men of Gilead and fought against Ephraim. The Gileadites struck them down because, now here we go, this is the power of words. Why did the Gileadites strike the Ephraimites down? Because they said, you Gileadites are renegades from Ephraim, from Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, what's the big deal about that? Well, by calling them renegades, they are literally saying that those who lived in the Transjordan, the east of the Jordan River, those who lived in the Transjordan were actually deserters from Ephraim and deserters from Manasseh. And those threats and those words were enough to cause a great battle. The Gileadites, verse 5, captured the fords of the Jordan leading to Ephraim. In other words, the Ephraimites had crossed over to the east side of the Jordan and were trying to get back to their side of the Jordan, but the Gileadites captured the way back. And whenever a survivor of Ephraim said, let me cross over, the men of Gilead asked him, are you an Ephraimite? If he replied, no, they said, all right. Now see, who wouldn't say no? If you know the Ephraimites are being killed because they're trying to get back, and they said to you, are you an Ephraimite? No. Me? No, I'm not an Ephraimite. So they had a little test for him. You see, it seems that the Ephraimites could not pronounce S-H. They could not pronounce S-H. And so they would say to them, all right, say Shibboleth. But they couldn't say Shibboleth. Ephraimites instead would say Sibboleth. Difference between an S-H and an S. If he said Sibboleth because he could not pronounce the word correctly, they seized him and killed him at the fords of the Jordan. 42,000 Ephraimites were killed at that time. 42,000 gave up their lives. Now, interestingly, Don Campbell of Dallas Seminary, in his commentary, says this about the Ephraimites. Their mouths got them into trouble, and then their mouths betrayed them. Their mouths got them into trouble, and then their mouths betrayed them. I was reading recently in the men's devotional Bible, and they were commenting on the Proverbs and what Proverbs has to say about the tongue. And I just want to share something from that with you, and then we're going to be done for today. Now, by the way, the Bible has a lot to say about the tongue and a lot to say about conversation, about speech, and about being careful about it. It calls the tongue a restless evil. It calls the tongue a world of evil. It says that the tongue corrupts the whole person, that the tongue sets the whole course of life on fire. Sometime for your own edification, do a study. Look up the word tongue in the book of Proverbs. Look up the word tongue in the book of Proverbs. You will get a master's course in how we speak to each other. Look up James chapter 3. Look up 1 Peter chapter 3. All important passages about how we speak to each other. But let me share from the men's devotional Bible. The ability to master our mouths, watch our words, and tame our tongues demonstrates a level of spiritual and emotional maturity. The opposite is true as well. An inability to control our speech shows immaturity, and it can inflict great harm on our relationships. In other words, when we fail to control our tongue, we don't just fail to give or be a blessing, we also cause a wound that can rupture a relationship. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I bet every one of us could say there's a time when what somebody said to me or about me just tore my heart out. Then he, in this devotional, quotes Rabbi Joseph Telushkin, author of Words That Hurt, Words That Heal, in which he states that when he speaks to audiences, he asks those audiences for a show of hands as to whether they can go 24 hours without saying any unkind words about or to anyone. Invariably, he says a few people answer yes, but most call out no. They can't go 24 hours with speaking about, badly about or to somebody. Those who, he goes on to say, those who can't answer yes have a serious problem. If you can't go 24 hours without drinking liquor, you're addicted to alcohol. If you can't last 24 hours without smoking, you're addicted to nicotine. And if you can't make it 24 hours without saying unkind words about others, you've lost control of your tongue. Wow, it's a great illustration, isn't it? If you can't go 24 hours without a drink, you may be an alcoholic. If you can't go 24 hours without a smoke, you may be addicted to nicotine. What does that say if you and I can't go 24 hours without saying something unkind about or to somebody? So they say this, how can you tell whether your tongue is under control? Well, the way you can tell is you won't say anything about an individual that you can't say directly to that person. You resist the urge to exaggerate. You consciously examine your thoughts and remove gossip and rumors from your conversation. You keep in confidence a personal matter that someone else shares with you. Further, you learn to speak positive words. Appropriate words communicate affirmation, comfort, and healing. Hasty, unnecessary words caused immense pain for Jephthah and his daughter and caused the loss of 42,000 lives because they couldn't control their tongues. Well, let's close this section of Jephthah, the nobody from Tob. That's from chapter 11, verse 1 and 2. The nobody from Tob winds up in the same breath with David and Samuel in Hebrews 11 because Jephthah believed and followed God.